Welcome to KABU, Judy Norsegian.
It's a pleasure to join you, Jan.
Well, Our Bodies, Ourselves, a project of second wave feminism, continues to this day, riding contemporary waves of feminism. And as part of our programming for Women's History Month, we're so delighted to have you on the Old Mole talking about some of that history of one of the foundational texts of second wave feminism and some of your current work. Let's start with the origin story, your origin story of that project in the late 60s with the Boston Women's Health Collective. Can you give us a picture of how that came about? I think it was in 1969.
Yes, its seeds were planted at a women's liberation conference held at Emmanuel College in Boston. That's a Catholic school, by the way. We never figured out how a women's liberation conference with so much explicit discussion of sexuality and reproductive health issues.
And abortion,
Yes, abortion was discussed as well. Some of those nuns were quite subversive, and I think they knew what was going to happen, although the name of the conference didn't suggest exactly what would happen. It was called Women's Liberation. And one of the workshops, which was co-led by Miriam Hawley, who is one of the founders of Our Bodies Herself, actually led to an ongoing set of meetings where women were really quite astonished by how ignorant they were about their bodies. They had all had bad experiences. They were sharing some about their relationships, but a lot about their medical care. And so they decided to educate themselves. Well, first they were going to put together a good doctor's list. And when they realized they didn't know how to evaluate doctors, they then moved on to educate themselves. They went to Count Wayne Medical Library at Harvard Medical School, and they met weekly, and they began to bond over this process as well. And there was no original intent to do a book. Out of these meetings grew some community workshops and gatherings and community courses. And then when so many people kept asking for the mimeograph papers that the women who had pulled together these community courses had prepared, they decided to then create a book. And it was a newsprint booklet put out by the New England Free Press, which was a left publisher at the time in Somerville, Massachusetts. In fact, the men at the press didn't think it was political enough, so the women had to put up the money for the printing. And many people know these first newsprint booklets, a little over 100 pages, cost initially 75 cents and went down to as cheap as 30 cents. And by word of mouth, about 250,000 copies sold in the early 70s, mostly in 1971 and 72. And it was the witnessing this phenomenon that got the commercial publishers interested, and they came to the group, which was not incorporated at that time. And several publishers vied for a contract, and Simon & Schuster won. And we incorporated in 1972 in order to sign a contract with a publisher. And that's when we became an official legal 501c3 nonprofit.
And I think part of what was radical about Our Bodies, Ourselves was not only its medical encyclopedic overview of women's bodies and bringing sexuality and reproduction together. I mean, part of it was bringing sexuality and body politics into thinking about reproduction, but also women producing knowledge themselves. It wasn't just about access, which I think has gotten often has been very central in abortion politics, the question of access to good health care, but it was also about producing knowledge and women constructing themselves and bringing the varied experiences of women into how we think about and represent our bodies. Can you talk about that part of the project?
Well, absolutely. That is what made Our Bodies Ourselves so unique. It wasn't just collecting decent factual information. And by the way, there wasn't that much good factual information. One of the things that astounded us was how much was done in medical care for which we had no good medical basis in terms of studies that would show efficacy and safety of the drug or the procedure. But that was just one piece of it. The other piece was, of course, our own experiences, our own knowledge of our bodies. It isn't just what we might find in the medical literature. It's what we know about our bodies and about ourselves. So the book combined fact and feeling. It combined women's experiences with findings from some of the medical literature that we found at that time. And of course, we were part of the movement that came a bit later, calling for better and more thorough research into a variety of women's health issues, because we needed to know more about everything, you know, the unnecessary hysterectomy rate, why there were so many cesareans, why psychoactive drugs were so overused on women, and whether there was any basis in this clear differential between how men and women were treated in the doctor's office. So those things were happening as well. But the book resonated so much with women across the country and across the world, because it did this amazing thing of bringing ourselves into the picture, having our own voices heard, making a stir, asking challenging questions, and going after the sexism, the paternalism, and the condescension that was rampant in medical care then. And that's in part because of the fact that the vast majority of physicians were men, more than 92%, and among obstetricians and gynecologists, it was about 98% at that time. So it was understandable when you combine the fact that these providers were mostly men, that they were trained to believe a lot of these very sexist ideas, that we would have a problematic experience in the doctor's office. And changing that was a lot about what our bodies ourselves began to do.
And alongside of sexism and patriarchal notions of women and medical authority is a certain paternalism that can be more pernicious or more benign, depending on the form it takes, where women coming into the field also can adopt paternalistic approaches to medical authority. And our bodies ourselves really challenged women also coming into the field to rethink questions of professional authority.
We did, and we were very quick to make a bond with those women, those feminists in medicine who wanted to speak out about what they saw as dysfunctional training, sexism, all the things that they lived firsthand. And so we early on made a close connection to Dr. Mary Howell, who was the first woman dean at Harvard Medical School. She wrote that famous book under a pseudonym called Why Would a Girl Go Into Medicine? And we're about to honor the 20th anniversary of her death later this month at a gathering in a local library with music and reflections upon her life. Her speeches to women medical students were so profound back in the 70s, 80s. She, even in the 90s, I cannot begin to say how much she had an impact on us, our thinking, our work, and other feminist physicians like her. They were out there, but their voices weren't often heard. And we began early on to understand the merit of working both inside and outside of powerful institutions, so that as we tried to change medical education and, for example, bring on much more about sexuality education, as Dr. Leaf pointed out years ago in some of the medical literature that he authored, medical students, residents, and physicians ultimately were profoundly ignorant about human sexuality, and in a way that made it possible for them to give very bad medical care. So they were leaders in the field within medicine, and those of us out on the outside saying, you've got to change this picture, because women and men go to physicians for all kinds of reasons, and many of them have to do with human sexuality, with sexuality issues and problems. Not all of them of a medical, biomedical sort of origin. There are many that have a relational origin, and being well aware of that is important for any clinician.
So in a sense, the medical gaze can be very much shaped by the anxiety about sexuality and women's bodies generally in the culture, and our bodies ourselves really throws off the sheet, so to speak. We used to talk about who's protected by that, all of those sheets that cover you when you go for an exam. And
I would go ahead. I would also say that early on we asked important questions about access to what. Yes, we wanted access to medical care regardless of where we lived and how much money we had, all those sorts of things. But we also wanted it to be good quality care. And if our clinicians weren't educated well, for example, in maternity care, so many bizarre things were done to pregnant women. And we wanted that to change. We wanted there to be what we call now evidence-based care, and care that reflected the needs and values and concerns of the childbearing family, a woman who was giving birth, her partners. And that change has been slow to come, even today, with academic medicine agreeing that the cesarean rate is too high. It is not coming down that quickly. And we know now from some very recent studies that one of the key routes to reducing the cesarean section rate, to reducing prematurity, to increasing breastfeeding rates, to all kinds of good outcomes, is to increase access to midwifery care. One important study that has a report card state by state just came out within the last few weeks, and we will be promoting that at the Our Bodies, Ourselves blog and through other mechanisms. This is another sort of important reproductive justice arena. But back then, we knew something was wrong with the picture, although we didn't know exactly how to fix it. And we were very quick to say, you know, we've got to do something. We've got to make allies wherever we can. We've got to ask hard questions. And we need to make sure that we hold our system's feet to the fire, that we improve the quality of care we're getting.
And part of that ongoing struggle involves differences within the women's healthcare movement itself over the scope of a feminist critique. How has the Our Bodies, Ourselves project taken up the Black feminist thought and the movement around reproductive justice that emerged in the mid-1990s and has broadened our notion of abortion rights and the pro-choice movement? Can you speak to that aspect of your project?
We very early on did adopt the language pro-choice, and we didn't like the term pro-abortion. We were fighting along with many others to achieve safe and legal abortion and access to services, which were not even available in places where abortion might have been legal. And then over time, as the voices of women of color began to emerge and were better organized in terms of their visibility to everybody else, we began to build alliances and make common cause, thinking about reproductive rights or reproductive justice in a much broader way, that it's access to contraception, it's access to abortion, it's access to good maternity care when we want to have children, it's access to providers who are not filled with odd ideas about how some women shouldn't procreate and other women should, so that sterilization abuse became a very serious problem in this country in the latter part of the last century. We decided to address this with all kinds of activism, and in the 70s and 80s, we even had federal guidelines that would insist that hospitals followed certain procedures to avoid sterilization abuse or risk losing their funding. Those things did have an impact. It doesn't mean that there is no sterilization abuse today, but we have to think about all of our reproductive capacities and yearnings and desires as part of a bigger picture.
Including needs to care for and raise children that are brought into this world.
Access to the kind of support you need to raise children. And that means that you get maternity leave and paternity leave, and you get paid leave, not just leave. And we are one of the very few places in the whole world that doesn't support a woman and her family after she has a child, and wouldn't need paid time off from work if she's working outside the home as well.
Well, Judy, Where can people find more information about the contemporary work and projects of Our Bodies, Ourselves, which is so inspiring in its sustained and not only continuing into the present day, but showing how knowledge is a very dynamic, changing process, responding to the needs of our time. In closing, the Our Bodies, Ourselves website is a place to go.
Yes, ourbodiesourselves.org is a great place to go. We link to other websites that are vetted. There are so many people out there doing important work. We're working with those trying to bring certified professional midwives into the healthcare system, not at the fringe, so that we can have better communication and better transfers from home to the hospital, an integrated system works much better, as we well know. We also have a great deal of information about abortion and organizations working on abortion.
Okay, well, thank you. And we can find out this and more on the OurBodiesOurselves.org website. Thank you so much for being with us today. This is Jan Hocken talking with Judy Nursejian, co-founder and former executive director of Our Bodies Ourselves. Thanks so much.
Sure.